Welcome to the Crown Council Mentor of the Month program. This is Steve Anderson. Our guest this month is the past editor of Harvard Business Review, one of the most influential business publications in the world. She is the past deputy editor of Inc. magazine and has worked closely with some of the business world's most influential thought leaders, including Michael Porter, Clayton Christensen, Dan Eisenberg, and many others. She's been recognized as one of the world's most influential, inspiring women. She is the co-author of the best-selling author, Dr. Clayton Christensen, of the book, How Will You Measure Your Life?, which is the subject of our program today. With that, we welcome Karen Dillon as this month's Crown Council Mentor of the Month. Karen, welcome.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
I have for years been a big fan of Inc. magazine. I'm an avid reader of Harvard Business Review, so I unknowingly have followed you for a long time and love How You Measure Your Life. And I'm very interested to get your personal insights into the work that you all put together and made this come about. For those that haven't read it, just a little bit of background is it really takes business principles and applies them to one's personal life. And so taking the title in context, maybe you could share with us with your extensive business journalism background, why is it that what an organization chooses to measure is so important? And then what lessons have you extracted out of that that translate into someone's personal life?
Well, I think it's one of those things that we all know in our heart is true. It's the reason we don't want to get weighed all the time, is because we can all think that we're losing weight until we actually get on the scale, and then we realize if we are or we aren't, that it's just a truism that what we measure, we pay attention to, and what we don't, they may be goals up on a board, they may be things in the back of your mind, they may be good intentions, but it's very different than measuring, tracking, and being held accountable for whether or not you're actually making progress against what you say is important to you as an organization.
So in what we measure in business compared to how you would measure things in your personal life, can you contrast or relate those two things and make the jump for us?
Sure. I think it's probably easier to imagine why we measure things in business and why that's so important. People who work for public companies know that they get monitored minute by minute. The measurement of their successes, is the stock price up or down? Did they meet their revenue goals? Things like that. And so there are lots of things in place to force companies to measure and be held accountable for what they say are their business goals. And by and large, it works. It may not be everyone's choice of how to run their business, but it is an effective way to make sure that you are on track for doing what you say you'll be doing. In our private life, I think many of us would confess that we don't hold ourselves quite as accountable, or often don't, or don't necessarily think that's important to do. But it's equally important. It's the same basic principle that what you measure is what, and what you hold yourself accountable for is what is actually important to you. So I mentioned weight loss in the beginning. That's an easy one. If somebody never gets on a scale, they never have to know if they're doing better or worse on their goals. If someone does not set financial goals and measure how they're progressing against those goals, they'll never probably make it a priority for themselves. There are so many ways in our life that simply choosing to actually take time, set goals, and measure, are you achieving those goals, how are you moving against them, is just extremely important as a way of motivating you to actually do what you say you want to do.
So what's the relationship then between goals that we and how you measure that, or measurement itself, or are they the same thing?
They're pieces of a puzzle, but I think many people assume that goals are the most important thing. And I think one of the things we tried to emphasize in the book, and what really hit home to me personally, that goals are just words, and they're things on whiteboards, or they're things in diaries and aspirations. How you measure your success against those goals is in your everyday actions, what you choose to spend your time, your energy, your resources on in an every single day way. So goals are important as a guidepost, but they're so far from being a good way to measure how you actually are prioritizing and channeling your business energy and information and people and resources and time that they're very different things. Goal is at the end of the game. The measurement and really, again, your resources, how you spend what's important to your business or to your personal life on an everyday basis, that's where the rubber hits the road.
So is there, in the context of how you measure, is there a hazard then that you make an error in the premise by the goal you set and then you're measuring the wrong thing?
Well, companies do that all the time. Yes.
Can you give us a company example?
I'll give you a good example. There's the steel industry is famous for basically allowing itself to be completely disrupted, undermined by competitors who were what's known as mini mills. They process steel in a different way than the traditional large U.S. steel and those companies had. And when the big steel companies started to notice that these small upstart companies, Nucor was a famous one, were starting to produce steel in a less expensive way for a market that this big industry had not really cared about, the accounting guys in the big steel industry looked at that and said, well, it's only a tiny little bit of the market. It would cost us more to get all set up to do this thing. We wouldn't make very much money. It's really not worth it. You know, what we're going to measure now is how much it's going to cost us to compete with those guys. And you know what? We don't really care about them. It's a tiny lower end of the market. Who cares? So they, because their goal was to stay being a big company and they thought this little thing in the middle was not interesting or important at all, they paid no attention to it. And in reality, they were actually paying attention to the wrong things. The reality was that those small businesses were going to start to little by little eat into the big steel industry and completely change the way steel was processed and made in America. And it really resulted in the downfall of the traditional old-line steel industry. That's an old example.
Sure.
Netflix is a good example of an upstart that came against Blockbuster, the traditional video store that you would go and rent your DVDs. Blockbuster paid no attention to Netflix, this little upstart on this tiny little piece of the market who just wanted to. You could get your DVD sent to you, and it sort of didn't matter when you got them back. It was a totally different business model. And Blockbuster paid no attention to it because they thought we'd have to spend a lot of money to compete with this little gnat of a company for this tiny bit of a market that nobody cares about. And, you know, cut to some years later, Blockbuster is in bankruptcy, and Netflix is the one we all think about as where we get our videos and entertainment.
So in a personal context, do we do the same thing in our personal lives?
Absolutely we do. We think we just pay attention to the wrong measurements of things that matter to us. We look at a decision, for example, in the context of what's the consequence of the decision right now. If I stay at work an extra hour tonight instead of making it home from my child's baseball game, you know, will it matter? No, it's just one game. It really won't matter. Next time, well, if I work this weekend because I want to get the project done and I miss an important religious event in my family's life, will it matter just this one time? Probably not one time. And the reality is we're measuring in sort of moment-by-moment decisions, but we're not recognizing the very long-term impact of how all those decisions add up. And in the cases I just mentioned, for example, they could add up over years and years and years, 1,000 little decisions that individually didn't seem to matter at all, into being a parent that's absentee or not involved in your family's life, or somehow adding up to a much more significant choice than you ever intended when you stayed that extra hour at the office or you skipped the family function. There, you know, we never think of things in the very broad context like the steel industry. Who cares? One tiny little day, one tiny little decision. They can add up over time to a much, much bigger decision than you ever realized you were making.
So what's the prescription in all of the work that you've done? What's the prescription and the balance between the exception, making an exception, and the rule?
The truth is you need both in your life.
Right.
If you follow the book, there is no one. Nobody at age 21 knows exactly what they want their life to be. They might think they do, and they might have some good intentions, but life is going to throw twists and turns at them. So they have to be open-minded to opportunities and changes in their circumstances and things that should make them look at things with a fresh set of eyes. So you can't be blinded about being devoted towards some very important but abstract goals in your life. At the same time, if you don't have a kind of compass, a North Star, a set of goals, the kind of person you want to be, the kind of life you want to be, you're going to just veer all over the place. You're not going to be headed in a direction. You're not going to make choices that take into account, I really want to be this kind of person. I really want my family to be a priority. I really want to do work that's meaningful. I really want to be active in my community. If you don't have that as a guiding principle that you're sure of and you've thought of and you've committed to in your life, you'll probably make lots of choices that don't get you towards those goals because you're not paying attention to your compass.
So is there a difference and how you draw, and maybe you could share how you draw the differentiation between the where you're headed or where a company's headed, and since we're dealing with both here, where you're headed and what the goal is and who you want to be?
Right. Well, who you want to be, Clayton Christensen, the Harvard Business School professor, who's the chief idea person in this book, this is something that he shares with all of his students, and I think it's a lovely lesson for people to think about. The origin of the book is that the last class of every semester, he's one of the most popular professors at Harvard. He gets all the top students. They love being in his class, and it's a very hardcore business course on business theory, how you use theories to make good decisions in your career and in your professional life. The last day of class, he says, turns the tables on the students and says, I've given you all my best thinking on how to be, how to live a great professional life and how to be good at your job and to rise to the top, but I want to make sure you use this good thinking, this best thinking, to make sure that you use it to have a great life too, because it's very easy to focus entirely on one half of your life and not on the other. So he spends the last class asking students to think about how has what we've talked about all semester, how can that possibly apply to your life? And all of the same basic principles that apply to running, leading a good business and a good career really do apply to running and leading a good life as well if you're very conscious of the choice. But no business at all, no successful business ever ends up exactly where they set out to be when they first started as a business. This is a statistic. It's something like, I can't remember the number, but it's over 90% of successful businesses have become something very different than they initially thought they would be. And perhaps the reason they're successful is because they've been open to circumstance, opportunity, emerging opportunities that should allow them to alter their course a bit. But at the same time, they've had some very big and important visions about generally where do they want to go. And I think that's all true for people. You have to be open to both while being very clear where the end destination should be.
Okay, so I'm going to press you one more step.
Sure.
I think this is really a key point that you've dealt with very well and that I love the way you deal with it in the book, is the balance between the plan that you initially set out on and then adapting to what unfolds in reality, because the overextension of any strength is a weakness. If I am so dead set on my plan that I'm blind to the opportunities that might come up, then I might miss it. But at the same time, if I'm so fickle that I run after every little opportunity that crops up, I never accomplish anything because I never stay the course.
Right.
What's the prescription?
Well, the prescription is you have to figure out that both, you have to be open to both in your life. For example, a prime example would be Honda. When it first wanted to enter the U.S. motorcycle market in the 1960s, it imagined and wanted to compete with the big American open road motorcycle companies. But Honda made these kind of tiny putt-around motorcycles that none of the motorcycle enthusiasts thought were very fun, and they just ignored them really completely. And Honda had a stock in California of these little putt-putt kinds of motorcycles that nobody was interested in. And in a moment of frustration, some of the salesmen took the motorcycles up into, they were called Cubs, up into the hills and started riding them around in the dirt just to kind of do something with the motorcycles that were sitting in the shop. And people started noticing, that looks awfully fun. And And one of those people was a buyer for Sears. And Sears eventually said, can we sell them in our sporting goods department? And that's a completely different idea than being on the waiting list for a Harley-Davidson and waiting a long time to have an open road bike. But Honda, a little recognized that in spite of its very well-reasoned plans to compete head-on with the American motorcycle market, it had an opportunity. And that opportunity basically led to Honda being a giant company now in America because it was open-eyed about that. But once Honda recognized that that opportunity was worth investing in, putting some money down, okay, this is something that's interesting, we need to actually develop this, it would have been foolhardy for Honda to keep trying a whole bunch of different other ideas. It's once you think you are on to something that works, when you know it's right and it feels like it's going to work, then you have to invest in it. Because if you don't invest in it, you'll just be scattered all over the place and you won't rise to being a great American motorcycle company.
Okay. There's a principle here that I know that you all are a big fan of, but is lost on a lot of people, which is that industry, let's talk about the business application of this first, that disruption in an industry usually starts in a specific place in that industry. You've mentioned now several different examples, the steel industry, the video industry, and now the motorcycle industry, and all those have something in common, which is the disruption started in kind of a little unnoticed, small little corner of the industry and then grew. Can you explain that little bit about the trend that you see in things that disrupt an industry and eventually revolutionize it?
Sure. It's sort of the enemy you might see coming, but you never pay any attention to, and it's in many, many industries. What happens is a company is onto, or an industry is onto, a successful product, service, business model, basically. They know how to make money from their customers. They've got something people want to buy and sell, and they do well in that industry. But then they start thinking, how can we grow? And they decide naturally that let's try to get more money, create a higher-end product. Let's go up in the market. Let's try to get customers to pay us more, to sign longer contracts, or to give us a higher service plan, to agree to that, something like that. So they start looking to how can I make more money and go higher and higher up into the sort of smaller margins of smaller era of where can I really get more customers or more revenue from the same customers. So they're looking up and paying attention to more and more profitable. What happens is these little tiny no-names, competitors, people who don't have any company at all, start something and they have nothing to lose. They're not losing their customers or their business, or they're not going to a smaller margin business model. They're just companies like Netflix who say, hey, we have an idea. We might be able to make money if we can get people to get DVDs by mail, and then they can keep them as long as they want because we make money by getting lots of people to sign up. We don't make money by the individual length of time that people rent our DVDs. So the big guys, like Blockbuster, say, well, we don't want that market. It's tiny. It's going to make a lot less money than we're making now. How could I go to my board and say, I have a great idea for a new product and service. It's going to be less profitable than what we're doing now. We're going to have to spend some money to invest in it. It's going to take us a while to get up to speed, and it's going to compete with us a little bit. So it's kind of like we're eating our own lunch, and we're going to lose money to do it. And so people think that makes no sense. Why would I do that? So they continue to look for the more expensive, more profitable ways to keep a subset of customers or elite customers. And they pay no attention to these little guys because these little guys are gnats. They're not of any significance at all. They're tiny little blips on the whole big picture of what they know as their company now. But what happens is those little guys get and figure out a good enough product or a good enough service, a service that customers actually want. And maybe they won't pay as much for, or maybe it's different than the other service, but they're willing to pay for it. So they take a little tiny piece of that market. Nobody paid attention. They're in there. They've got a foothold. And then little by little, they start figuring out how to expand their market because there's a lot to go. There's a lot to grow into. We're just this little tiny bit of the market. And so basically, they disrupt. They completely change what is the status quo in these established, very profitable companies and industries. And people pretty much never see them coming or don't pay attention to them or don't think they're a threat until it's really too late.
All right. Now, you may say on this next one, Steve, you're stretching the principle beyond where it was meant to go. But is there an application there personally?
Oh, interesting. Let me think about that for a second. Is there a personal application to disruption? Well, I'll stretch to a different place, which isn't your question, but I'll tell you how I have thought about it in my own life.
Okay.
At the end of, I was the full-time editor of the Harvard Business Review and worked with Clay Christensen on this book and James Allworth, the other co-author. And the project was so life-changing for me that over the course from the beginning of talking to Clay about this class that he gave to his students until when the book came out, I decided that I needed to change my life to be true to my goals. You know, the things that I said were important to me, I wasn't really measuring. I wasn't really spending my everyday energy, resources, time on the things that I would tell everybody were the most important things to me. And in my case, that was my family and my personal life. It was I would tell everybody in the world that was the single most important thing to me, and it was my goal, and I meant it. But if you looked at my every single day calendar, you would say, not so much. I don't think so. Where are your children on this calendar? Where's your family on this calendar? Where's your husband? So I decided that, like a good disruptive company, the only way for me to really compete with my existing successful model of my life, it was a relatively happy model from a professional standpoint, was to disrupt myself, was to completely wipe away all the things that I knew were solid and established and the way things were done, and start with a blank piece of paper and say, you know, what piece of this life can I get that will be exciting and give me opportunity to grow and change? So personally, I think I disrupted my own life to get to a better life model than I had before. If that's not too big, Chris, that's how I think.
Not at all. No, I think one of the in reference to your earlier comment is that we make these little decisions along the way, not really realizing that those little decisions end up to be big decisions and big outcomes. And it may be some of those little seemingly inconsequential things, the little nuisance over there in the corner, the Netflix, the steel industry, the Honda, whatever it is, those little decisions that end up being the disruptive thing that unravels the personal life. Is that a fair analogy?
I think so. I mean, you can look at it in your personal relationships, whether it's in family or close friends and relatives. You can ignore investing in those relationships for a long time. And marriages don't fall apart in a day. Children don't you know, become estranged from you in a day. It's 100 little decisions that you might make over a very long time that, if you're not measuring or paying attention to, will add up to a surprise, a shock, disappointment for you at some point down the line because you haven't paid attention to those small little nuisance things, the child who's needy, the mother or father who we haven't spoken to in a long time. They're just, they'll wait, they'll understand, I'll get to it. It's sort of like ignoring the competitor in the corner. You know, those things become bigger, and they have momentum of their own, and they add up over time to very different choices than you ever thought you were making, you know, one by one by one of those choices.
Let me merge business with personal life here for just a moment, and if you could address, for those in leadership and management, which is just about everyone listening, how does the work that you've done potentially impact how someone leads people and manages human resources?
There's a part of the book that was profound for me as a long time. I've managed dozens of people, maybe more, over my career, and it was so important to me to have reinforced what the impact you can have as a manager or a leader on lives, not just the lives even of the people who work directly for you, but the lives that they go home to. Imagine someone coming home from an office after a great day and feeling fulfilled and doing work that matters to them. They come home probably a reasonably happy person versus the person who comes home from work at the end of the day feeling beaten down, I did nothing interesting, there's nothing in my job that inspires me, and coming home to a home life that may not, you know, they may not bring any joy or any sense of anything exciting home or happiness at the end of the day. That's a very different mom or dad or roommate or friend who comes home, you know, the version A and version B. So as a manager, if you're very conscious of the impact you can make on people, one of the fundamental principles in the book that is true for all of us as individuals and as for people that we manage is that what motivates people, what really motivates people, is not the superficial things that you can put on a resume or you get an end of the year review in salary hikes or bonuses or titles. It's actually something far more intrinsic and fundamental. It's, am I doing work that's meaningful? Do I feel challenged? Does my boss believe in me and inspire me? Am I working with people who appreciate me? Those are things that are intangible and that we as managers and leaders may not consciously think about every day. But I think if you do and you think about the people who are working for you and with you, you can have a gigantic impact on, again, a ripple effect of people if you're conscious of, is this work challenging? Am I giving the person my confidence? Are they doing work that's meaningful? And I don't think I can't think of a single job that a good, well-intentioned manager could not make better in all of those regards if we put our mind to it. And I can think of lots of jobs that if we neglect them or assume they're just sorry, those jobs just are the routine ones or the boring ones, you'll never keep people. You'll certainly never have motivated workers because you haven't factored in how extremely important it is to make sure that the people who work for and around you are motivated. That's the difference between people being happy in their work, truly fulfilled, and just being not unhappy in their work.
So it really is, if you're truly going to be a manager and leader of human resources, it's really connecting what they're doing with some greater purpose and fulfillment rather than just doing the job. Have I got that right?
Absolutely. That's one piece of it. Greater purpose and fulfillment, that they feel it can also just be challenged. It can be that they have to feel that the work they do matters, but they also want to be challenged. They want to be stretched to learn. They want to work with people who appreciate them. I think all those things are relatively easy for a manager to think about and to try to adjust and tweak so that the people feel the smallest things sometimes can make the difference between a person feeling motivated to come to work every day and feeling like they're just putting in their hours between 9 and 5.
You give some very vivid examples of people who got it wrong when it appeared on the outside they had it all going right, and then what the ultimate end result was. Could you highlight maybe one of those examples and then maybe pinpoint where things got off track or where the error was in the thinking?
Sure. I will. There's a couple that are in the book, but I think one that people have responded most to is Clay Christensen, the Harvard professor, was a classmate of the Enron CEO. And they together were good guys. They were in class together. They liked each other. And Clay went on to be a very respected Harvard Business School professor. And the Enron CEO, as we know, is in prison. And at reunions and things, that would just stump Clay. What happened? This was a good guy. I know he cared about his family. I know he was ambitious in a healthy way. What happened? How that guy never went to Harvard Business School imagining that he would end up in prison someday. What happened? And the truth is he executed a strategy to end up in prison. That's really what happened. He didn't mean to. He certainly didn't mean to. No one ever says, I'm going to start fiddling with accounts because I know it will get me in prison, but that's okay. I can live with it. People assume
right.
They can make a little indiscretion here. I can move this here. I can just do something just this one time, and it will be okay. But the truth is that step by step by step, you are starting to execute a strategy that will lead you completely down the line. So Jeffrey Skilling, who's the Enron CEO, obviously executed a strategy that would lead him to prison, to not a happy, fulfilled family life. I'll just leave it as in that way. And he never, ever could have intended to, because no one ever does. Athletes, for example, who I'm sure Lance Armstrong is the same thing. Whenever he first crossed that line to doping his blood or steroids or whatever the first choice was, he never, ever in a million years could have imagined, and it will lead to the complete ruin and humiliation of my career, my children being ashamed to me being struck off of the record books, all the terrible things that have happened to him in the past few years, because he did not think just this once, just this step, I've just crossed this line, was actually the beginning of executing a long-term strategy for shame and losing all that you had built. So it's so easy to see things just in the context of the moment. What does this decision matter now? But it always is a step across the line that makes the next step across the line that makes the next step across the line something completely different, and it adds up to a picture none of them would have ever wanted to have been where they are now if they knew that that first step was going to lead them where they are. They just wouldn't. No human being would.
So if you were to contrast that with maybe an illustration that most accurately depicts the message of how will you measure your life, what would it be?
There's a story that Clay tells that I find profoundly moving, and I think probably your listeners will as well. Clay is a very religious man, and he's also a giant. He's 6 foot something and a wonderful basketball player. So his whole life he's been an athlete. And he was a scholar at Oxford. He was a Rhodes Scholar, and he was on the Oxford basketball team when he was a young man. And his basketball team worked so hard, and they made it to whatever the UK equivalent is of the championships, to the final rounds of the games and the series and the title that mattered. And he was an excited, enthusiastic, very important member of that team. And when it came down to the final few games, he looked at the schedule, and it dawned on him that one of the key matches was to be played on a Sunday. Now, Clay is deeply religious, and he had made a promise to God that he would not do things like that on Sunday, and he wanted to keep that promise, but he didn't know. They were his friends. This had meant so much. They had worked so hard to get there, and he discussed it with his coach, and his coach said, oh, come on, just this once, I think God will understand. Just this once, can't you play? You'll be letting your teammates down. And that was a very difficult decision for Clay because maybe he was right. Maybe just this once it wouldn't matter. But I know he went away and he was really contemplative about it, and he came back and decided there is no just this once. If I break this line, cross this line that I have said is really important to me, just this once, I'll do it again and again and again. So it's easier for me to keep true to my principles 100% of the time than it is 99% of the time or 98% of the time. So he didn't play. And that was a really hard decision for a young man with lots of peer pressure from buddies who thought he was needed. And they did win without him. So as he would say, maybe he wasn't all that important after all. But I know he looks back on that, and I find it so profoundly moving as a keystone decision in his life. It was a moment where he realized that I have to decide what I stand for, and I have to stick to it. I have to be true to it 100% of the time. I can't be a convenient religious person. I can't be just when it's convenient, devoted to my family or whatever your personal parallel may be. If you decide what you stand for it and stand for it 100% of the time. And that story would extend to the ethical decisions that Jeffrey Skilling made, that Lance Armstrong made, that Nick Leeson, the guy who brought down Barings, the bank in the U.K., if you can't stand for what you stand for all of the time, you don't stand for that. It's that simple.
As a starting point, with all of this work that you've done, where would you suggest that somebody start to get on the right path of accurately measuring their life in a meaningful way?
Well, I think, it's a long and honest conversation you need to have with yourself. One really needs to think, what really, truly matters to me? You know, don't look at your schedule. Don't look at what people tell you matters to me. Don't look at what seems to be urgent at the moment. Go away and really think about what do I want my life to amount to? What kind of person do I want to be? And how will I measure my life? And if you can start to think about those things and really have an honest conversation with yourself, not one that anyone else needs to be part of until you've answered it for yourself, you're not doing it to impress people, you're doing it to lead to your own long-term personal fulfillment. If you can have answers for that, how will I measure my life? What matters to me? And what kind of person do I want to be? I think that's a really important starting point because I did that for myself. And I didn't like my answers when I compared it to the life I was living, which was, again, in some ways extremely happy, but in other ways absolutely not what I thought I meant was important to me. And until you have that honest conversation, I don't think you can start on the path of trying to adjust what's really not right.
You shared with us earlier a personal example of some changes that you made as a result of doing this work, and maybe you could wrap up and maybe share with us the most powerful lesson that you learned, if you don't mind a little personal disclosure, because I can't imagine doing the amount of work you did on this body material and not coming out of that a different person and living life differently. So what was maybe the most powerful lesson you learned, and what impact did that have on you?
The most powerful lesson probably was that actions cause things to happen, decisions cause and effect, that choices I was making actually had an effect, and I had to be very conscious of that. And so the gist of it was that I recognized that I was not spending my energy and resources, my personal time, on the things that really, truly are the most important things in the world to me, which is my children and my husband. And so I had a very big, consuming, happy career, but it was one that was all about me and my happy, big, consuming career. So I shocked lots of my colleagues, and with goodwill on both sides, I resigned my full-time job as the editor of the Harvard Business Review, and I became a part-time writer and editor doing projects that motivated me, that made me happy, such as working on this book with Clay, and a full-time mom and wife that doing things that made me even happier, which was basically being present in my own life, not just assuming I would get to that someday. And I've spent about the past 2 years doing that, and I am on a scale of 1 to 10, I'm 35 in terms of personal happiness. I can't imagine what my life would have been like if I hadn't shifted course early enough in my children's lives to be very present as their mother. That's so it's so special to me. And so I've continued to do work that matters profoundly to me, which is writing and sharing ideas with people like your audience that matter, and working with people that I like to work with. But I've made my personal life and the people who I care about my personal life my number one priority, and that's been a fantastic disruption of myself.
Well, there's nothing better than a teacher who walks the talk and can personally endorse the work that they've done. So I appreciate you sharing that with us. How will you measure life? Is there anywhere that it is not available?
It's pretty widely available. It's in lots of languages around the world, and there's a short version. The Harvard Business Review article that I initially worked on with Clay is available free online, hbr.org. You can find the short article that led to the whole book. So even the short version you can get right away as a free version, and you can certainly find it in bookstores and Amazon all around the world.
Perfect. Karen, thanks so much for sharing your insight and your wisdom today on how you measure your life, and we all hope to follow your example by doing something different as a result of what you've shared today.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks so much. So as a summary of our conversation today with Karen Dillon, I thought I'd just inject a few summary thoughts and some things that you might consider as action items to follow up on. Seven things. First is a reevaluation of what your goals are. What really are your goals? We've had four things that we've reiterated over and over again over the years. These four questions: do you have goals? Are they written down? Do you review them every day? And do you physically see them? Are there some place where you can physically see them every day? So a reminder there. Number two then is, how do you measure your progress in each of those goal areas? How really do you measure progress, and what is your measurement system in all of those areas, especially in your personal life? How are you measuring progress? Number three is to really take a serious look at the where you're going, the goal, versus your who goals. In other words, who you want to be. So the where you go can only lead to a result, and as Karen mentioned, can lead to a result that you never intended. In other words, if you have the destination defined with no boundaries of the type of person that you've committed to be along the way, you may arrive at a destination that you never intended. And Karen's given us some great examples in Enron and Lance Armstrong is the where overrode the who. So what are your who boundaries? You have to set boundaries in terms of who you are willing and not willing to be in order to get where you want to go. How will you measure your life in those areas? Because if the who is not defined, then the where may be a destination that you never intended. Number four, disruptive technology. What are the areas in your life where you need to disrupt things and interrupt the pattern, the habits, the things that are going on that maybe you need to take a different look and say, you know what, we need some disruption here to redo and get on a different track. We got some great illustrations in business in terms of Netflix and Honda and the steel industry. And perhaps from time to time, that same thing needs to happen in our own personal lives, is to engage in some disruptive technology and question the status quo, question the things we're doing, and saying, am I really on the right track or do I need to stir things up? Next, take a look at your human resource skills and how you're managing the people with whom you work. What really motivates people isn't necessarily the incentives and the bonuses and all of those things, but the things that really make them people, meaningful work, appreciation, a good work environment, challenge. How are you really motivating and creating the environment that takes into consideration the whole person, not just the goal that you're trying to achieve in the office? And how can you manage your human resources better to take the entire person into consideration, not just the working person? Next, goal versus strategy. Is the strategy that you're pursuing going to lead you to the full goal, or are you just deceiving yourself? When you arrive, will you be the person that you want to be? So what's your strategy? What's the strategy you're pursuing to really reach your goals, and can you articulate that strategy as well as you've articulated your goals? Along with that is this thought, is what do you really stand for? If you don't stand for something all the time, then you really don't stand for it at all. So a little paper and pencil exercise might be in order to say, what are the things that I really stand for in my personal life and in my business, and do I stand for those things all the time, or are there just exceptions? Finally, cause and effect. Are you spending your time, are you creating the cause that will ultimately get you the effect or the result that you want? When you look at how you will measure your life, are the inputs that you're honestly putting forth going to give you the output that you have stated or that is your intention? Cause and effect. So a few points of food for thought in each of the areas. It's a great book. I will say that How You Measure Your Life is one of the most sophisticated business books that I've read, but also has some great personal application. So get ready to go to business school if you dig into this. But there's some great life lessons as well as great management lessons that will help you not only measure your life, but help you measure your business and be a better leader and a better manager. Thanks for joining us for this month's Crown Council Mentor of the Month. This is Steve Anderson. We look forward to our visit next time.